In this week's programme, The Letters of T.S. Eliot, we're looking at the third volume of these, which includes letters written between 1926 and 1927. They were edited by John Haffenden and Valerie Eliot, the poet's second wife. She married Eliot in 1957 and died in November 2012. Eliot himself was born in 1888, died in 1965. During the period covered by these letters, the now celebrated literary magazine, The Criterion, of which he was then editor, moved from being a quarterly to a monthly. With me, Professor Eve Patton, who is head of the School of English at Trinity College Dublin. Her most recent book is Imperial Refugee, Olivia Manning's Fictions of War, published by Cork University Press. Colin Graham lectures in English at NUI Maynooth. He's curator of the Illuminations Gallery at Maynooth, and co-editor of the Irish Review. Bill McCormack is author of the recently published Dublin 1916, The French Connection, and has been concerned for many years with the politics of modernist literature. Colin, what did you think of these letters? How did they strike you?
I thought they were fascinating insight into Eliot in a very short period, just a couple of years, dominated obviously by his correspondence around the Criterion and contributors, rejections, acceptances, the development, further development of a coterie of people around Eliot, but also running through it this extraordinary strand of his personal life and his marriage to Vivian, a very painful at times, very personal, very tortured letters, both about her, from her. In that sense, you got a real picture of Eliot's life, both as on the surface of a very civilized, developed literary life, and underneath something in great turmoil.
Yeah, what age you say? He's what, late 30s, around touching 40 thereabouts, isn't he?
Yes, yeah.
When these letters. Eve, what struck you when you read them?
Well, I think Colin's right. This is just such a wonderful portrait of the other writers in the period who were trying to make their name, who were trying to find publication in Criterion, and who were really writing to Eliot on a regular basis. And a lot of these people have now been eclipsed for one reason or another. I was very struck by how close he is in this period, not only to Pound, who, of course, had supported him much earlier, but also to Wyndham Lewis, who comes through as a very distinct and very influential personality in the correspondence.
And Bill, I want to hear your reaction to the letters overall.
Well, I think disagree from my colleagues. This seems to me a collection of business letters primarily with, as Colin says, some very painful personal material interfiled. And I find that the tone shifts really rather disturbingly from the rather ruthless commissioner of reviews for the Criterion to an extraordinarily pleading figure who is writing to the director of the British Museum asking for his card, his visiting card, his admission card to be renewed. And in those kind of letters, you know, you meet an Eliot who really is unpleasantly basking in his own humility. And there's that tone of the possum, which I find very disturbing.
If we start on the personal note, you mentioned some of the moving letters. There's one from Vivian herself to John Middleton Murray, and she's saying that, this is in 1926, whenever he speaks to me, Eliot, that is, about himself and his interests, work, thoughts and desires, I know so frightfully that I don't understand him. Sometimes when she is tired or overwrought, she thinks he's mad.
There are several letters from Vivian to Middleton Murray, which are very distressing indeed. And you really get a glimpse here, because these letters have been included, of just how unstable she was, not only physically, but of course psychologically. And the terrible effect this has on Eliot, and the distress that he, between the lines, we can see him suffering. And one thing that also comes through is that Eliot is often in poor health alongside her, and they both go through these various cures, hot and cold water treatments and so on the continent. And I think that's probably where I disagree with Bill. I don't think we get a sense here of Eliot, the egotist, at all. I think we get a sense of him as very self-effacing. And he writes in one letter about his desire to be self-effacing. A lot of that, I think, comes from the distress of his personal life, the need to hide certain things. There's one letter that he writes to his mother in April of 1927, where he says to her, "Don't send me back my letters, just destroy them. I don't want my biography, if it's ever written, to have anything private in it. I don't like reading other people's private correspondence. I don't want other people to read mine." He wasn't a man who was trying to set up a legacy at this stage.
Fill us in on that, Colin. Has anyone tried? What efforts have there been made to write biographies of that kind?
There have been biographies of Eliot which treat him both very favourably.
Peter Ackroyd, I remember. That's a long time ago.
Yeah, Peter Ackroyd is a long time ago, but it's a very, very perceptive biography, I think. I'd say it's my favourite of them all.
Yes.
And particularly about this period, Ackroyd is brilliant on this period, particularly on his religious beliefs and Eliot's religious beliefs, which he understands very intimately.
But were there any kind of priming works, Bill, any attempt to sort of...
Well, there were various efforts to write notes towards a biography of Eliot, even while he was alive. What strikes me about this question of his self-effacement is that it brings us very close to something which is vitally important, and that is the theory of impersonality, that he says most poets, when they go wrong, are personal when they should be impersonal and impersonal when they should be personal. And this is clearly a very important frontier for Eliot. Now, over the volumes of correspondence which we will finally have...
We tend to forget the second part of that. They're impersonal when they should be personal.
Yes.
That part tends to be
indeed.
Forgotten, doesn't it?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. But it's a very sensitive frontier for him. And when we get the full collection of letters, perhaps we'll appreciate this in a full context. The problem for the reader of this volume 3 is that the business context is really dominant. And I think maybe we see sides of Eliot which perhaps might have prompted him to say, you know, don't keep my personal letters, don't keep my business letters either, because they reveal at times a very manipulative figure who succeeds, of course, in being his own publisher.
Can we look at the ruthless editor or the meticulous editor? There's one to R.P. Blackmore, whom we know as a very distinguished critic in 26. He's returning a poem, Eliot, that is, that Blackmore sent him a year ago, and he's told this poem is not one that can be rewritten. It's too good for that. The poem is too thoughtful, but in turning thought into poetry, it must be felt thought. That was a big idea of Eliot's, wasn't it?
It was, but I think this is a very interesting thing about the letters. He's not always ruthless. He's often very decent with the people who write to him. There's one very funny letter from a man called James Smith who writes to him, sends him poetry. And the poetry, Smith says, it's an imitation of Alexander Pope. And Eliot says, "I tried this once, and it was a failure. I destroyed my poems. I recommend that you do the same with yours," which sounds very cutting. But then he takes Smith under his wing for a whole 2 years after that and cultivates his writing. The same thing with a woman called Viola Tree, who Faber tells him that he must stop using this woman for writing her column in the Criterion. He writes to her very decently and says, it's not you, it's just that we're not going to do this column anymore. She writes back and says, "Oh, come on, it's me." And he says, "Oh, please don't force me to comment on this." So I think there's a real decency to him at times. He rejects the criticism of Houseman, for example, not because he thinks that Houseman's poetry is good, just because he thinks it's unfair at that stage in Houseman's life that he have a negative review. So I was quite impressed with him at times as a man of decency and integrity in his business dealings.
He turned down a poem from Auden, obviously a very young Auden. "I don't feel that any of the enclosed is quite right, but I should be interested to follow your work." And then Auden tells Isherwood that given Eliot's reserve, this was a compliment. So he reframed what the cognitive therapist would love him. Auden reframed that rejection.
I think this is why this particular volume of letters is so interesting. You're seeing in formation as it happens, the new generation begin to try to make inroads.
Yeah.
And the letter from Auden is key in that. And look at, you know, the famous names that are being turned down. There's Gertrude Stein, not accepted by Eliot at one point. Look at the way he writes diminishingly about Lawrence. You know, this is the landscape as it was in the middle of the 1920s and all the competing voices that are here. And I think it's very interesting to remember that these letters are also written at a time when Eliot was working as an academic, in effect. He was giving the Clark lectures, and he was in the company of figures such as I.A. Richards. So English literature as a discipline was in formation in this period too. And you've got that very mobile backdrop to the letters coming through.
Writing to Charles Norman Bell, who's described as a Russian-born poet and biographer, he says, Eliot says, "When I criticise other people's poetry, I refuse to accept any objections based on references to my own verse. I've made a great number of mistakes myself." He's covering himself well there. Yeah.
Yes, well, I suppose he's also acknowledging the assistance of Ezra Pound in reducing the wasteland to manageable proportions. Yeah. I think this notion of Eliot being a decent chap is fine, providing one adds the codicil that the circle he's dealing with has a very distinct political coloration, and that there are issues arising in the 1920s which are not simply those about the formation of English as an academic discipline, though that's very important. For instance, there are political issues. McGreevy, Thomas McGreevy, and he figures very compellingly in this collection. McGreevy is trying to get a book published by Wishart, and there are problems, and he asks Eliot's advice, and Eliot tells him, you know, there may be a Jewish connection. Mm. Now, this is not the only moment in this volume where we come across this. He rather snidely says he doesn't have an Alfred Mond to support him.
Yeah.
And, of course, in A Cooking Egg, he makes distinctly anti-Semitic comment.
At this juncture, people tend to say two things. Either, one, it was of its time, or secondly, that it didn't affect the work.
Well, The Cooking Egg is really about various kinds of hate, and Sir Alfred Mond is part of it, is one of the victims. I shall not want capital in heaven, for I shall meet Sir Alfred Mond. We two shall lie together lapped in a 5% exchequer bond. Now, part of this, you know, the banal rhyme and so on, takes us into the kinds of letters where sort of childish language and childish feeling emerges.
Do you think, Colin, that Eliot has got off light in the matter of his politics?
Well, it's the specific issue of anti-Semitism has been raised in the last few years, and this volume does add to that issue, because the anti-Semitism in this volume is casual and widespread amongst his circle. It's also occasionally very specific, but it's also complicated. Laura Riding, for example, I think, is a quiet sufferer of Eliot's anti-Semitism, which only appears in Now and Again. But she is rejected constantly by him, and it's clear that he's very irritated by her, and at one point it becomes clear that her Jewish background may be behind that. Having said that, it is slightly more complicated. There's an issue, for example, with a man called Kurnos, who wrote a novel in which Richard Aldington, one of Eliot's friends, was featured as a character, and Pound features in that too, and H.D. And Aldington is outraged that Kurnos is writing for the Criterion. He's been a long-standing friend of Eliot's, and he says he will not go on writing for the Criterion as long as Kurnos writes for it. And Eliot says to his friends, well, look, Kurnos has done nothing wrong that I can see. I didn't know about this. I will have to tell Richard that Kurnos will go on writing for it, even though it causes him great pain. Kurnos is Jewish. So he rejects one of his own long-standing friends on this for the sake of keeping on someone who, for whom he sees he's made a commitment. And so anti-Semitism doesn't raise itself there. In fact, when Aldington himself is raising it, he calls Kurnos a ghetto gutter snipe. So anti-Semitism is widespread in his circle in a very casual way, but it's not a straight anti-Semitic politics at this time. And that's one of the reasons, as Eve was saying, why this is so fascinating, because it's on the turn into the 1930s. Eliot himself is beginning to move away from Pound, for example. At the end of this volume, you see he begins to critique Pound as an aesthete, as a still living in the world of the Yellow Book. And he says, what we come up against now is politics, economics and religion. And that is so prescient about the decade that he's heading into.
Eve,
absolutely.
Did you
think that there's just no clarity with regard to the issue of anti-Semitism. Yes, there is a particular reference in one of the letters to Jewish agitators on the continent. But at the same time, what we see is the friendships. Look how close he is to both Leonard and Virginia Woolf, for example, and how dependent he is on Leonard Woolf at this period. He has many friends who are Jewish. But I think the broader picture is significant. It's the question of the route for democracy that comes through between the lines of so many letters. When he talks about how significant he sees Wyndham Lewis and how Lewis's text, The Art of Being Ruled, which is in publication during this same year, is going to be very, very important. Mm. It's about authoritarianism.
Also, how close he is to Action Française.
Well, indeed.
Right through the whole way, Bill, yes.
I think that when we talk about the Wolfs, we're talking really about London intellectual life, and there certain rules of what you might call tolerance or fraternization exist. When you look at Eliot in a European context, and I think that is everywhere in this volume, he's interested in Russian literature, German literature, French literature. When you look at that European context, and Action Française in particular, his politics is not democratic, absolutely not. And the long letter to the editor of the Church Times from November 1927,
yes, yes.
In when he tries to tick off the Church of England for, in turn, writing about the Pope's attitude to Action Française. And his argument, which seems to me rather diffused and evasive, but one thing is clear. If he has to choose between the Church of England, the papacy, and Charles Maurras, he's with Maurras.
Maurras. So the Action Française is to the right of the Vatican. Let's get that map
And it has
map clear.
Divisions and battalions.
As we say, and he remained an admirer and defender of Maurras, yes. In a way. Just the mischievous side of Eliot, there's a letter here to Humbert Wolfe, who's described as a poet, satirist and civil servant. He's inviting Wolfe to write about a contemporary. Is there anybody you particularly detest and would be malicious about? So old Tom had a mischievous side to him. Yeah.
There are the odd glimpses here of a slightly more fun side to him. The letters to Bonamy Dubray, for example, in which they develop a kind of cod theology and write about it. But most of these letters are fairly sombre and I think serious. This was a man who was running or involved in a serious business that was often in financial stress or under financial stress during the year. Think how this is the year when the Criterion itself began to be threatened by withdrawal of funding and have to be rescued by Faber. Really, the business side of him that Bill was a bit negative about at the beginning is, I think, what sustains a lot of the interest in Eliot at this point.
Of course, he'd been in banking. I mean, that was his background. His attitude to Shelley, his dislike of Shelley, how do you read that, Colin?
Yeah, I think it's that notion of the revolutionary Shelley that he dislikes. And this goes back to what Eve was saying, that one of the things that's fascinating about this is that in this, even this pre-scrutiny period, you have this idea of Eliot going to the Clark lectures, and the people who are there are Tilliard and Leavis and Richards. So that a negative comment about Shelley and by Eliot at this period has this ripple effect down through, potentially down through the whole system of teaching and formulating English literature.
He says, Bill, of Shelley, he seems to me one of the dullest of the great English poets. Mind you, he does say great English poets, and my prejudices have only been strengthened recently by reading Professor Whitehead's praise of that author in his Science of the Modern World.
Well, one of the things that this establishes is that Eliot hasn't read Yeats on Shelley, because if he had been reading Yeats on Shelley, he would have found a much more positive perspective. I think the argument about Shelley is, of course, takes us back to the argument about personality and impersonality. And these romantics, I mean specifically Keats and Shelley, are loathed for a certain kind of effusive personality. Seems to me a rather crude reading, but certainly it was one which was very popular in Eliot's time. I think there is playfulness, and sometimes Eliot is the, as it were, willing victim of other people's playfulness. There's a great little exchange with McGreevy where McGreevy says he's thinking of getting married. But if he does take this step, he will do it in a Unitarian church. And Eliot replies, "Hey, well, why would you go to that kind of extreme?" And McGreevy defends himself by saying, well, Stephen McKenna went over to Unitarianism and abandoned Rome a couple of years ago. Now, I think all of this is entirely bogus. And because, for a start, McGreevy didn't marry, and I'm not sure McKenna became a Unitarian. Yeah. He was a Neoplatonist. But what they're all doing is having a joke at Eliot's own inherited Unitarianism.
Mm. By the way, didn't he commission from McGreevy a book about the Russian ballet?
Yes, there are quite a few very interesting details about what McGreevy might have written. For instance, there's McGreevy's putting together a collection of essays about George Moore, which never appears. There are also interesting signs of Eliot trying to get Edmund Burke into print again, which never happens. But we do see Eliot working very positively, I think, to put together a certain kind of mix of politics and literature.
Beckett was very close. McGreevy and Beckett were very close, because at this point Beckett was just, 21 or so? So he doesn't figure nor might he be expected to be in that. So I take it McGreevy was much older than Beckett.
Yes. I mean, McGreevy had fought in the First World War. He was a Kerry man, as most of our listeners will know. And I would have thought was regarded as a Catholic intellectual of a very distinct European kind. The idea of him going over to Unitarianism seems to me one of the better jokes in the book.
He wound up as director of the National Gallery, of that. Also, he says there's a little bit of comparative work going on where Eliot compares Henry James unfavourably to Hawthorne, Hawthorne being much more universal in his remit. Do you recall that?
There are various comments like that. One of the things that I found very interesting in the book generally was how American writers begin to be eclipsed at this period, and there's the shift to the Europeans. And it of course, is a part of the background to one of the defining moments in Eliot's biographical process at this point, which is that he takes citizenship, he takes British citizenship. Yeah. He tries to keep it a secret for a long time. He knows that this will be regarded, partly by his own family, with some concern. But he'd made a remark about how, I don't want to be a squatter any longer. And I think that sense of one of the conversions is very important, that he wanted to locate himself now in a particular tradition. Remember how already in this period he's using that word tradition, and that he wanted to be not only British, but I think European.
I don't know if his remarks about Whitman can be seen in that context, where he compares. He says that Tennyson and Whitman are alike in terms as versifiers, but in fact that Whitman had a decidedly inferior intellect. His political, social, religious and moral ideas were negligible.
Well, I think that it's the same with Hawthorne and James there, and indeed with Shelley and John Donne. There's a look back in Eliot in this period to the 17th century, and that 17th century can be a kind of American 17th century, the tradition of a kind of Puritan Protestantism that carries on into America. So when he makes that distinction between Tennyson and Whitman, it's a similar kind of distinction that he makes between James and Hawthorne. It's the same thing that you see when he gets very tetchy with F. Scott Fitzgerald, who he knows he should have in the Criterion, but he can't really bring himself.
Because
F. Scott Fitzgerald is too American. He's too contemporary. He's too much satirising the people that Eliot was, and the kind of person that Eliot was, the kind of background that he comes from. So in his own mind, Eliot, I think at this point, it's to do with his conversion both to Anglicanism and his adoption of British citizenship. He's imagining himself in some way as a kind of founding father figure of the United States, and tracing that lineage right back to Queen Elizabeth.
And feels, in that context, the need to repudiate certain American writers. Bill, your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's very important to note why we're taking so much time over this volume of letters. Eliot is an astonishingly important poet. Now, we don't see much, as it were, of the working poet in this volume, because it's concentrated on 2 years, which were not particularly productive. But he is the figure, with a little help from Ezra Pound, who, for English poetry, creates an idiom which is decidedly non-Victorian. Even Yeats, you know, is lapped in various kinds of Victorian garlands. But Eliot, with the poems 1920, has set up a new idiom for English poetry and verse. And that means a break with the past. It certainly means a break with Tennysonian notions of English versification and metrical work. Eliot almost parodies this at times. And I think this is why we're so interested in the creation of the circles which he moves in and assists, and some which he excludes, because he has been a very important poet a couple of years earlier. And we know, of course, that Quartets has yet to come, Four Quartets, which I think, personally, is the great achievement. So we're interested in reading these middle period letters, knowing something about his impact as a poet, as a revolutionary poet, really. But I personally feel the collection of letters is rather indulgent. You know, we're told minor letters have been excluded. There's a six-line letter to his old tutor in Oxford, which says nothing, but which carries a 36-line footnote to it, which includes a few pleasing anecdotes.
By the way, what does he mean by saying he would like to have been Shelley's tutor at Oxford?
I think it
would have been. Put him straight, put him right.
But I think this
is a cynical view. I think he could rely on Shelley to have got out of Oxford and he wouldn't have had to bother with him. That's the ideal relationship with all students.
This is the period, though, when you see there's not much poetry written, but this is a period in which Eliot is about to shift his whole way of writing. So there's an interesting rejection of the term modernism, for example, in one of the letters. Somebody offers him an article on surrealism. He rejects it completely and says he's no interest in it. Why would anybody write about surrealism? And the poem that comes out of this period is Journey of the Magi. And that is the big change. That's the thing that no one understands when that poem first appears. No one understands what Eliot is doing. He completely confuses all the people who write to him in this volume, praising him for The Wasteland. And they're confronted with Journey of the Magi. And these letters explain why that shift happens and how it happens.
We've been discussing The Letters of T.S. Eliot, Volume 3, 1926 to 1927, edited by John Haffenden and Valerie Eliot, and published by Faber. My thanks to Eve Patton, Colin Graham and Bill McCormack. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie and on the RTE player. Till next week, bye-bye.